Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He has worked with 11 presidents, cast more than 25,000 votes, and tomorrow, Michigan Congressman John Dingell becomes the longest-serving member of Congress ever. On today's show, we will speak with Congressman Dingell about his 57 years in D.C., and then a drama company takes a fresh approach to Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, performing not in a theater, but instead out in nature. But first, it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. This week, it seems the topic is the fact that the proverbial day of reckoning is at hand when it comes to the city of Detroit. Hi, Daniel.
How are you?
I'm good. Well, the hue and cry set off when the word got out that the treasures at the Detroit Institute of Arts could be in the crosshairs as Kevin Orr tries to work out settlements with the city's creditors. What message does this send to everyone outside of the boundaries of the city of Detroit?
Well, I think it sends several messages, but principally I think it says that Detroit's financial problems are a lot of other people's as well. I mean, there are a lot of people all across the state of Michigan, and certainly in Southeast Michigan, that view the DIA as number one, a gem, and number two, as their gem. Mm-hmm. They're either members or they go there occasionally or they go there regularly, and it's in play legally as a legal matter and technical matter and financial matter. So I think we're going to have to wait and see how this thing plays out. But the hue and cry that has happened in the last week or 10 days, I would say, is only because people have been paying attention. This has been an open secret for a very long time.
And as you point out, there is actually there's money from the Tri-County area involved in this. That millage that was passed involved Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties. So what do you see if indeed some of these art treasures begin to get picked off?
Well, I think anything that is perceived by outsiders politically or financially or both to be suburban taxpayer money that is being moved into the city either to pay creditors or to maintain operations of the city and finance operations will be the death of those millages. That's why they set up arts authorities in each of the three counties. Mm-hmm. They are there to safeguard that the money goes into the DIA. It doesn't go beyond the walls of the DIA. It supports the DIA's mission and operations, period. One of the things that Governor Rick Snyder and Emergency Manager Kevin Orr and their people are urging the DIA to do is, okay, we don't want to sell the art, they're saying, but your assets are city assets. Are there ways that you can use the assets, some of the 90% of your art that's not on display, to generate some kind of revenue for the city, that you could create exhibits that you could sell to museums around the country, something like that? Well, the problem with that, I think, is that as a political matter, now they've gone down the millage route. The concern is that anything like that is perceived to be supporting this, using the art to support the city as opposed to using the millage to support the art, will kill that. And then that then creates a need for the DIA again to be raising between $18 and $20 million a year in an environment where donors are going to be very leery to be making large donations to an art museum if they believe that those donations are ultimately going to be used to pay off creditors, pension funds, unions, whatever the case may be. I think there are ancillary fears as well. People, I think they're fearful that they're going to lose staff, that the curatorial staff will leave. What's really important to understand here, whether people agree with it or not in the broader public, art museums at the level that the DIA is part of a very elite club in the United States and, frankly, around the world. And like any elite club, there are written and unwritten rules about how you operate within that. And one of the expectations is you don't sell art to retire debt. And I think there's a lot of people inside these organizations that, frankly, are very leery about being part of something if they were to go down that road. So there is a very distinct prospect. And I think they feel this at the DIA, that they could lose curatorial staff, they could lose development staff, they could lose, you know, people that are either put in impossible situations or are worried about what this says about their career going forward. You know, one of the things that's been floated is potentially selling exhibits around the country. As it's been pointed out to me, those can be $500,000-$600,000 a pop, and this small number of museums that can afford things like that may say, you know what, we're not going to take part in this because the only reason you're doing this is because you're in financial distress and they're forcing you to do something with the art, which is something we don't want to be part of.
Such a catch-22. It's really catch-22.
Well, that's exactly right, and I think the governor and the emergency manager and their people understand that there are things they don't know, and there are things that they don't understand about the art world, and how you're able to, how you can extract value, if you can extract value. And I think one of the things they've been doing in the past few weeks is, you know, looking for solutions. There have been meetings between DIA people and people that work for Kevin Orr saying, here's some ideas, what do you think? And the DIA is coming back and saying that's not workable, or that gets us in problems with our millage, or, you know, all that kind of backing and forthing. So it is a catch-22, and they keep going around in circles. Now, the other thing we have to lay on top of this is, as we speak, and certainly into next week and the week after, they're going to be, Kevin Orr is going to be meeting with creditors. And one of the things that they do in these meetings, as I understand it, is they start to lay out, these are the obligations that we have.
Okay.
These are our pots of money. This is how much we can pay. And they begin that process, because everything, even in a pre-bankruptcy filing, is all about negotiation. Now, creditors can say, well, I don't care what your problems are. I want 100 cents on the dollar, period. And then it begins this negotiations back and forth about what they want versus what the city can afford. And I think creditors, the fear is that creditors will use not only the DIA, but other assets of the city, the water and sewerage department. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people believe that the water and sewerage department, because it is a revenue generating asset that serves 4 million people in Southeast Michigan, that will be a prized asset that will work into this whole equation, and that somehow some of the debt on that will be renegotiated, and they may change who owns that actual asset and create something that can generate some revenue. That's all to be seen. But the point I want to make is that creditors, they cannot force the city to sell. This is a very important point. They can't force the city to sell the assets. But what they can do is they can tell the judge, if they get to that point in a bankruptcy proceeding, they've got more assets, they're not bringing enough to the table, and the judge can either agree with them and say, you're right, go back at it, guys, or he can say, I don't agree with you, and somehow the DIA's collections end up unscathed. Truth of the matter is, there is no case law that covers a situation like this. This is true legal virgin territory.
Now, we touched on this when we talked last week, Daniel, and I want to get your thoughts a little more deeply on this. To those who will say, well, too bad, getting police to be able to answer a call or getting streetlights on for public welfare and safety, that's more crucial and more important than having a Van Gogh or a Rembrandt or a Degas hanging on a museum wall. Are we going to hear more of that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think you're actually even hearing it from Kevin Orr. You know, just before we started talking, I was looking through his report, and in it he talks about shared sacrifice, and he talks about how employees have taken it on the chin quite a bit already. And, I mean, he's trying to kind of set the table and even this out. And the reality is that this process is financial, and it is negotiated, but it's also political. And I think you have to recognize that the DIA, as an example, and I don't want to just pick on them or focus on them, but cultural organizations whose assets are owned by the city aren't necessarily a very significant or sympathetic, I should say, victim in this case. Because there are a lot of people that look at this and say, you know, these artworks are worth enormous amounts of money. You got to choose between art and people. And the one thing that I think the governor and the emergency manager want to avoid is that choice. Hmm. And because they know that the optics of it are so clearly against the art in that respect. It's among the broader community, not among the big donors and the patrons. They believe in this very much, and I understand that as well. And the DIA is a real gem in the community.
Yes, yeah.
But that is one of the more unsavory pieces of this. And, you know, as I wrote in today's piece, we've seen this before. You know, General Motors lost half of its brand stable going through bankruptcy. There were things that they never thought would happen.
Yeah, stuff really got ugly and got real, didn't it?
And one of the truths of what happened in 2008, 2009 is that the people in this town, and particularly at General Motors and to a lesser extent at Chrysler, had a failure of imagination. They could not imagine that what ultimately happened could happen, much less would happen. And I think that's kind of where we are with the city of Detroit now. There are things that are happening now. This process is running along, whether the elected people want it to or not, and it's going ahead. And where we're going to get to on the other side, I don't think any of us really know. I don't think even the governor and the emergency manager and the potential creditors, I don't think they know where this thing ultimately ends up, because so much of it is going to be litigated, negotiated, argued about, back and forth. There'll be political pressure brought to bear on certainly by unions and their representatives on the process. There will be political pressure brought to bear, I think, on the governor and the Republican power structure in the state by donors of things like the DIA, who also happen to be donors to the state Republican Party and to the governor, who will also try to pressure the situation. So I think this is just beginning, and we really don't know where it ends. This is a huge story, Cindy.
And I know we'll be following that. And as you say, the tip of the proverbial wreckage, and certainly something that if people outside of the city of Detroit had been kind of thinking, well, it's their problem, it has certainly been a wake-up call.
I think that's right.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Always enjoy our Thursday check-ins. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Time to brush up your Shakespeare, as the Cole Porter song goes. And while you're brushing up on your Shakespeare, you can get in touch with Mother Nature in Ann Arbor. It's pretty common to find outdoor summer productions of Shakespeare. They happen across the country. But for 13 years, Shakespeare in the Arb has been staging the Bard's plays outdoors in a very unique way. Shakespeare in the Arb is kicking off its 13th season with Much Ado About Nothing. It's being presented by the University of Michigan Mathi Botanical Gardens and Nichols Arboretum and the University of Michigan Residential College. Joining us is Catherine Mendeloff. She's a lecturer in the drama department of the Residential College. Welcome.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
There are so many other outdoor productions of Shakespeare to be found around the country, but I'd like you to tell us what makes Shakespeare in the Arb so special.
I think that the marriage of the work, the play, and the environment is what makes it special. We really try to make the Arboretum a character in our productions. When we start the rehearsal process, we go out to the different areas that we're going to be staging in and just explore them creatively to see what things we can do with the hills, with the trees, with the grasses, how we can make those environments enhance the comedy or the beauty of the language and the reality of the environment of the play. And so that what I want is for the audience to really feel that they've gone to a different place, to a different time, that we're in the Elizabethan setting, that we believe we are not in Ann Arbor anymore, but we are in Messina at the estate of the governor, Leonardo. And that's something that I try to do by staging moments as the audience moves from place to place. We have Elizabethan musicians taking us from place to place, and I try to incorporate elements that also pay attention to the time of day, like lanterns or tiki torches, to try to bring us in this emotional state of being transported to another world.
So everybody moves.
Everybody moves.
From scene to scene. Audience gets up and moves. And so that has to take a lot. Are people just sitting on the grass, or do you have chairs?
Right. We have people are encouraged to bring something to sit on.
Okay.
Chair sitters sit in back of the ground sitters. So we allow the groundlings to get the best view. So if you're able to sit on a towel or blanket, you will be able to get closest to the action. But every time we move, you replace yourself so that you'll end up seeing the play in different ways, depending on where you're sitting, what the angles are. And of course, the wonder of working in nature is every single performance is different because the weather conditions are different. The cottonwood is blowing in. Sometimes deer walk through the scenes. The sunlight will make different kinds of shadows. It's very magical because it's in an environment that, you know, we are subject really to. The lighting design is by nature, and the sound design often by nature as well, except when the university helicopter comes by.
Oh, that's very Elizabethan,
jars
isn't it?
Us out of our reality a bit. But I tell my actors to react as if they were Elizabethan people hearing a noise that they don't understand. So often they take their swords out. Sometimes they hide behind trees. They react to the modern noises in a
character.
Way that's in character. Yes, exactly.
Well, every theater group has those war stories of the things that just go incredibly haywire, and of that makes good war stories.
Right.
Can you share any from these last 13 years? I'm sure you've had moments where Mother Nature just has put her foot right in the middle of everything.
Well, we definitely have had some cloudbursts. Ironically, for a play like The Tempest, we had clear weather the entire time. So the characters were talking about the clouds and the rain and the wind, and it was tranquil and beautiful.
Mother Nature's going, no, not playing, not playing.
One of my favorite moments is the very first production, which was Midsummer Night's Dream. There's a moment when Puck, and I cast three people as Puck, so it's a tripartite Puck, talks about sometimes a horse I'll be, sometimes a hound. And at that moment, three dogs came running into the valley, just ran through the scene, barking, you know, hysterically. And it was just phenomenal. It was perfect timing.
As if you'd cued them.
That's right. And we have had deer come through when the Duke, the exiled Duke in As You Like It, is talking about the deer. But you can never tell. You can never tell. I didn't, unfortunately, have a bear come in during Winter's Tale. We had to have an actor in a bear costume. I was really hoping there was a black bear sighted in Dexter.
Okay.
I think at that time I was really hoping he'd make his way over at the right time. But
he was,
I don't know if
cute.
I wanted to direct him.
Now, you have an interesting mixture of actors, Catherine Mendeloff, in a chance for community theater folks to kind of share the stage with professional and teachers. Tell me who you have.
Well, it's really a wonderful mixture. It's I teach at the Residential College, which is now the home for the Literature, Sciences, and Arts BA in drama. So these are students who are not part of the pre-professional school at the School of Music, but who are very interested in drama and want to study it. And so a number of my students participate in this. Also, students who have majors in a variety of things, you know, engineers, pre-med, who just love theater or love Shakespeare, will get involved. And then I have a group of my ARB veterans. I have actors in this current production. One, the actress playing one of the Beatrices, I've worked with since she was 8 years old in the Young People's Theater.
Okay.
So it tends to be something that people, when they do it, they love it and they want to do it again.
They're in. They're in for more.
Yes. And I have colleagues. A professor at the School of Social Work is one of my actors from engineering. So these, again, are people who just love doing this, even though it isn't their, you know, isn't their job.
Now, as you're staging this in Shakespeare in the Arb, and Much Ado About Nothing will be starting tonight and running through the 23rd, so it's the 13th season. So you've got actors and you've got your audience moving from scene to scene, going through the Arb. How do you handle all of that?
It's very complex. We had a wonderful stage manager working with us this season who's used to working on university productions that are far more organized and easier to control.
And on a stage in a theater.
Well, you know, the question is who holds the swords when we don't need the swords? Because we don't want to put the swords down. Someone might take them. Someone actually took three of our swords last year. We want to make sure that everything is returned up to the Reader Center, the building up by the Peony Garden. So, yes, actors have to be responsible for their own properties. We do costume changes in the woods, out of the sight of the audience. I tell all the actors that as long as you're in character and you're reacting in character, it's fine for the audience to see you. But you have to make sure that you're still part of that world. It's very important to maintain that illusion. So the actors are moving from place to place to make their entrances in character. So sometimes people have to sprint 100 yards to get to their entrance point. And I believe that's one of the reasons that I've cast characters like Puck and Ariel. I had 7 Ariels when I did The Tempest, because it's not a question of just stepping off to the wings.
Right.
You are sometimes running a half mile. And the audience is watching you run. I think about that a lot in the staging. For example, in Much Ado, there is this funeral for Hero, who is supposed to have died.
Right.
And I have the audience move through the Heathdale, which is this beautiful woodland glen. It's very dark and shaded, secluded, and very magical at night, and it also holds sound beautifully. But this Heathdale was where I felt the audience should actually witness this funeral for Hero, and we have 2 beautiful Elizabethan songs that are being sung, and the characters are in mourning, and the audience is part of that funeral procession. So I try as much as I can to make the audience feel like they're part of the play itself and not just observers. And the actors interact with the audience as much as they can and really engage them directly.
It's clearly something that people love, and it's working, because it's the 13th season now for Shakespeare in the Arb, kicking it off with Much Ado About Nothing, and it starts tonight, runs through the 23rd. And Catherine Mendeloff's been speaking with us, a lecturer in the drama department of the Residential College at the University of Michigan. Pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. I hope you get a chance to come to the Arb.
It's entirely too easy to overlook that senior citizen standing in line with you at the post office or at the grocery store. But take the time, strike up a conversation, and you may well be astounded at what that senior has done or lived through in his or her lifetime. That's why we wanted to tell you about something called the Legacies Project. It was launched in Ann Arbor, and it brings seniors and high school students together in a very special way. Here to explain all of this is the co-founder of the Legacies Project, Jimmy Rhodes. Welcome to Stateside.
Great to be here.
And joining Jimmy is a teacher at Skyline High School in Ann Arbor, where students have been interviewing Ann Arbor seniors. Patricia Jenkins, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's also good to be here.
Jimmy, I want to start with what led you to co-found the Legacies Project.
It's really a personal story. My dad died in 1993. I was in my 20s, and we weren't talking. And it's not that we were estranged, but, you know, what 20-year-old wants to talk sex, drugs, and rock and roll with your dad, the old man?
Yeah.
So we just talked about things to keep it light, right? The avoidance
surface
topic.
Stuff.
Yeah. How about those lions?
Yeah.
And that was never a good conversation to have. So we just avoided it. And then you get that notice from a doctor, 6 months to a year to live, cancer. Mm-hmm. And I'm living in Chicago at the time. And every weekend I would drive in. And I decided on a drive in, now's the time. I got to get to know this guy. And I talked to him in a way I'd never spoken with him before. And I knew him, characters revealed over time.
Sure.
But I found out more about his biography in the last 6 months of his life than I did in the previous 26. And it was a transformative experience. And then the flip side of that is a couple of years later, I had an aunt who died, who had no children, had never married, they don't call them these anymore, but at the time it was a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a good situation. There's some very good situations and there's some very bad situations. She was in a bad situation. And just making my way to her room would take 40 minutes. There'd be a lineup of old women in chairs, wheelchairs, grabbing at my arm, literally saying, "Honey, will you just talk to me for 5 minutes?" So it would take an hour to get to her room just because I would sit and chat with people. And I realized there was a therapeutic value in having your stories heard and appreciated for the seniors. And the missing piece was when we're like, well, boy, how can we cast a wide, wide net to get a lot of these stories? Because when you aggregate them into a database, they have more value when you have overlap, content overlap, multiple points of view on a topic. And I said, we need free labor. And, of course, that's students. But there had to be an exchange. So we created curriculum around it, and we tried to make it an enriching experience for students so that we could basically say, listen, we need you to do this work for this archive so that future generations, these stories won't be lost to them. But we're going to try to make it such a valuable, such an enriching experience for you that it's totally worth it.
Yes. So as a teacher then, Patricia Jenkins, tell me how you can incorporate the Legacies Project in working with your students and what it means to them.
Well, I lead one of four magnet programs at Skyline High School. This program deals with communication, media, and public policy. It's a three-year program, so I have sophomores, juniors, and seniors. And the goal is to have them become video producers as well as policy analysts. The Legacies Project is a perfect fit because their junior year, they focus on acquiring those video production skills. And so through Legacies, we do some training in how to work with seniors, some gerontology training. We do some training about how to interview subjects and human experimentation, sort of the institutional review protocols. So they get that training before they meet their seniors. And then when they meet their seniors, they learn how the Legacies Project is a way for them to understand how to put equipment together, how to put together a camera, the importance of audio, the importance of lighting, the importance of active listening, asking questions, being able to ask follow-up questions on the spot, and building that relationship, that intergenerational relationship with their senior citizens, building that trust. And then they also, Legacies gives them a real-world opportunity to do the video editing, to take all of the stories that they've heard, all the wonderful sort of life stories they've heard, find one that really resonates with them and edit that down into a shorter version, a 3 to 5 minute segment that that we show to the community. So it hits a lot of buttons. It hits sort of skill buttons in video production and editing. It hits sort of those world of work skills in terms of listening, being on time, how do you greet someone, handshake, eye contact, how do you dress appropriately for a senior, all of those skills. And there's this added bonus of reinforcing what they've learned about U.S. history, because they're talking to someone who's lived through maybe Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, has been born in their house. I mean, they're learning about real history through the lives of a real person. And it's very transformative. I think one of the things that surprised me was how well the students bond with their senior and bond with each other as they hear, they're all together sort of hearing these life stories.
So this is a win-win-win. Everywhere you look at it, this is win-win-win.
Absolutely.
You brought a couple of examples of the students' work.
Oh, yeah. I brought in one. Somebody that many of your listeners may have heard of, Ethel Potts. She goes by Epi, usually Epi Potts. She got into politics, and she is to this day very politically active. And it was great hearing her encourage students to be politically engaged. And she talked about how she got hooked on local politics.
I joined a group that picketed the city council for a fair housing ordinance. And then we all went into the council chamber and they passed the ordinance and then everybody went home. But I didn't. I stayed because I could look at their agenda and some other things seemed interesting. So I sort of got hooked on council meetings to see the what was happening locally. And what happens with most people, something happens in their neighborhood. The bulldozers arrive next door and they suddenly get really interested in what's going on.
That's wonderful. Well, tonight is when these will be screened, these videos, the Glacier Hills Senior Living Community. It's at 7 p.m. At the Hansen Room in the Manor Building. And you can learn a lot more about the Legacies Project, including watching some of the oral history sessions on their website, legaciesproject.org. And we've been speaking with co-founder Jimmy Rhodes and Pat Jenkins, a teacher at Skyline High School. Thanks so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
A piece of history is being written in the United States Congress. Tomorrow is the day when John Dingell becomes the longest-serving member of Congress ever, surpassing the late Robert Byrd of West Virginia. He began representing the people of Southeast Michigan on December 13, 1955, and 57 and a half years later, he's still there. Congressman John Dingell joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Blessings on you. Glad to be here, and thank you.
Take us back, if you will, Congressman, to that first day in 1955. Can you tell us what were your feelings as you walked onto the floor of the House for the very first time as a United States congressman?
Well, I was a green congressman, brand new, and I always thought I was quite ready, but I found out later that that wasn't right. I was following a great man that I very much admired, my dad. And after I was sworn in, I had the privilege of responding to the House, which had had a day on which they were celebrating my dad's service and honoring him for the hard work that he had done for the people for 23 years. So it was a rather special time, and to be perfectly truthful with you, I broke down and cried when I had to respond to what the giants of the House of that day, people like Rayburn and John McCormick, who was his dear friend, and Daddy Doughton and Jerry Cooper and all the others, Democrats and Republicans, got up to say some very kind things, I think fully deserved, about my dad.
I dare say there are not many figures in American politics who could say that they had such a personal start to their life of public service.
It was a very personal thing. And, of course, remember, I was brand new, had family in the gallery, had some friends that had come down from Michigan, had just finished a very hard fight where I had to beat 23 people, some of whom were folks that had run against Dad, and folks of no small prominence, including the National Committeeman, former mayor of Detroit, past commander of the American Legion. And the fellow that gave me the worst fight was a wonderful, wonderful old African-American minister by the name of Reverend Charles A. Hill, who had a voice like thunder.
It's interesting as I hear you talk about the guy that gave you the toughest fight, and you say wonderful, wonderful. And I get this sense of a spirit of collegiality that existed no matter what your party affiliation. Has that been lost?
Regrettably, yes. And very regrettably, because it was one of the things that made this place work. I've had to defend the fact that people compromise. And then this is criticized quite savagely by both sides, the far right and the far left.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand that this was what the Founding Fathers intended we would do. We would address the problems of the people, not in a partisan way. In fact, they contemplated no parties. But the interesting thing was that we were supposed to work together to compromise so that every member and every person represented by any member here would have the right to be heard and the right to participate in the legislation which governed their country.
And you feel that we've lost that sense of that today?
Regrettably, it is largely lost, and sadly in two ways. The awful partisanship that we see, but more importantly, by the fact that the rules that led to openness, to the opportunity for all to participate, have been very much abraded and breached and diminished.
What price are we paying as a country for that, do you think, Congressman Dingell?
Well, you're seeing prodigious deadlock in this institution. And you're seeing the Senate, which was never really regarded as a legislative body, all of a sudden becoming the legislative engine for things being done. They did it on Affordable Care Act. They're doing it on immigration. And they did it last year on the budget, while the House sat back and engaged in these monstrous battles amongst each other mm-hmm. over things that should not be the subject of controversy.
And as that has changed, can you tell us how just day-to-day life in Congress has changed from what you first experienced in 1955. I mean, we hear certainly people in Lansing talking about how folks come in, and because, of course, we're term-limited here in Michigan, so as you know, they're gone. But what is the rhythm like today compared to when you began in 55?
Well, the House here in Washington and the House in Lansing share many of the same common difficulties and problems. When I was here, there were great friendships across the aisle. That's largely gone. When I first came, you had members who had served for a long time who knew the issues and who worked together to resolve the issues and to find a middle ground and to have compromise. Compromise now becoming, as I've said, a dirty word. And conciliation and cooperation and coordination are very, very important to good legislation because, as I've said, everybody has a right to be heard and every member of Congress has a duty to see to it that all of his constituents are properly represented.
You are a member of the Greatest Generation, as Tom Brokaw has made that that name so well known, and you served in World War II. How did the time that you served in that war affect your thoughts or your philosophies about public service and government?
Well, my approach to government has been affected by a lot of things. I've known a lot of the giants, Harry Truman. I once had the privilege of being in the same room with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I heard Winston Churchill speak to the House and the Senate. I've been able to meet all kinds of people, great and small. And I've had the privilege of seeing the events that have occurred since I was born, the Depression, the bank collapse, the war, the attempts that we made to bring ourselves out of the Depression, the fact that we thought we could lose World War II, The period of Reconstruction. I watched Roosevelt. I heard him speak to the House. I saw Harry Truman making decisions. Harry quite frankly, saved me and 500,000 Americans by dropping the atom bomb on the Japanese. And had he not done that, that would have been the number of people would have been killed in the landing and in the subsequent campaign in Japan. And he saved an untold number of Japanese. We had the privilege of being idealistic. We went off the war. It was, as has been said, the last good war. No war is good, but at least the people were united on it. And then we came home and we were all determined to rebuild this nation and to see to it that things happened that were good for the country and good for the people. And politics was an honorable calling, and people participated, and they loved the country, and they were all there trying to make it better. Even some of the weird ideas we had were advanced by people who were honorably seeking to make things better. I find a lot of that is gone.
Congressman Dingell, I'm interested in thinking of the years that you've spent, these 57 and a half years of meeting people and your constituents and hearing their concerns and their problems. Have those problems and worries and concerns changed over the decades?
Oh, the problems have changed slightly. But the problems that I'm helping people with now are not startlingly different than what Dad did when he was here. If you look, you'll find that members of Congress help with Social Security or pensions or the military or immigration. Those things are still there. We help business with getting regulations that work and make sense. We help people in dealing with regulations or with tax matters or unemployment comp. And those problems are still there. Sometimes the attitude or sometimes the specific problem is different because times have changed. But the basic fundamental difficulties that people have and the basic responsibility that members of Congress and elected officials have is still to help people on the same kind of things that they did when I was a small boy, win a political fight.
It must be very personally hard for you to look at the public approval ratings of Congress that are just dismal. What needs to happen, do you think, to improve that image of Congress in the minds of American voters?
Well, I would say the first thing that ought to be done is the members of Congress and people who seek high office should cease attacking the office and cease attacking the system. I see all kinds of people running for Congress saying what a terrible place it is, denouncing their colleagues. I see all manner of outrageous behavior and outrageous comments made. So as a result, when they get here, they all of a sudden find, by golly, nobody likes me. because of all the things that people are saying bad about the Congress, of which some are true and some are partly true, but most of which are untrue, because this is a place where honorable men still work and try to make things better for the country. And the second thing I'd say is the media should do a better job of seeing to it that people understand what a treasure we have and what a fortunate race we are in being Americans and in having the greatest system of government in the world. I think that the average citizen should participate more and actually be active in community and political affairs. I'm not saying which party you ought to belong in. Obviously, I'm a Democrat, and I can tell you that's the place to be. But the hard fact is everybody ought to participate, and they ought to insist that government is clean, that it's open, and they ought to insist that the representatives in the Congress and elected office, that they address the nation's problems, and they do so in an honorable way, and that the debates not be bottomed on personal attacks and on all the vicious and evil things that we see and hear being said, and all the falsehoods that are said as to win elected office or to those things would carry us a long way forward in making us a better country.
Congressman John Dingell tomorrow becomes the longest serving member of Congress in American history. Thank you for speaking with us today on Stateside.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Brooms up. This weekend in Genesee County, there'll be a big exhibition match of Quidditch. Yes, that's the sport played by the witches and the wizards of the Harry Potter novels. Since true witches and wizards are in fairly short supply around these parts, this will be Muggle Quidditch, Muggle being the name applied to all of us non-magical types. College players from U of M, Michigan State, Eastern, University of Toledo, and more will be playing the game at the Deer Run Soccer Complex in Linden Township. Joining us to tell us just how a game created in the imaginative mind of author J.K. Rowling has become a surprisingly serious sport for these muggles is Christina Packard, a former Quidditch player with Michigan State. Now, for those of us whose knowledge of Quidditch is kind of confined to having watched some or all of the Harry Potter movies or a knowledge of the novels, start by explaining what Quidditch is.
The best way to describe Quidditch, I guess, is it's sort of a mix of like basketball, rugby, dodgeball, and tag. Just so that people can get a sort of a general idea.
Yeah.
And really, it's a fantastic game to play. It's a lot of fun. It's fast-paced. There's so much going on at one time for everyone to watch that, I mean, nobody can leave, you know, without a smile on their face because it's exciting.
And I have seen some of the YouTube videos of players. So certainly we know that, you know, we watched the movies and we saw Harry and the other players whizzing around doing amazing things on broomsticks in the films. So the question is, how do you translate all of that action to a soccer field in Genesee County?
It was originally adapted back in 2005 by Middlebury College students. And from there, it's literally just expanded. The International Quidditch Association exists, and there's actually a huge rule book garnering everything around Quidditch. So pretty much just like the books, you have the three chasers, the two beaters, the keeper, and the seeker. And then the three chasers each handle the quaffle, which is sort of like a deflated volleyball versus like the red ball with the little indents in the movies.
Okay.
That's the ball that you try to shoot through one of three hoops that are of varying size. Unfortunately, our hoops don't fly in the air like they sort of do in the movies.
But, well, unfortunately, neither are you.
Yeah, and we certainly don't fly in the air, but the broom is still a big part of the game. It helps to sort of have a one-hand handicap. If you dismount your broom, you're actually considered out of play, and you have to go back and touch your hoops, remount before you can re-enter.
So you are running around holding a broom between your legs.
Yes, that is true, and it sort of makes it a little bit sort of a humorous part, a little bit of, you know, whatever. But, I mean, it keeps it exciting. It keeps it sort of have the whimsy, imaginative, whimsical, look to it. So.
And then the little gold ball with wings that Harry and Draco and the others are chasing is called a snitch?
Yes, that is correct.
All right, how do you translate that into your game?
The snitch actually ended up being translated as a person was the best way to do it. There was different schools that sort of tried, like, radio helicopters, that type of thing.
Yes.
Didn't really work so well. But the way it works is there's a person that's neutral to both sides of the field. So it's not on either team. They're usually dressed in all yellow, and a lot of the times are like acrobatic wrestlers, like people that are really just a little bit on the insane side. But they have special shorts that you can buy through Quick, or you can use just a long sock with a tennis ball in the end that sort of hangs out of their shorts. And that's the ball that ends the game. The snitch, the person themselves, has a bigger running area than just the pitch that the game takes place on.
Okay.
And the two seekers get to chase him around this area. And once that ball is caught by either side, it's 30 points for that team and the game is over immediately. But the snitch can push people down, can tackle them, can, you know, sort of throw the seekers around. It can get kind of violent, really. They do anything to protect the ball so that the game, you know, you never know when it's going to end.
Now, are there youngsters who are coming up and playing this as well as college? Like, where are you getting your new players from?
Well, a lot of what we've been doing with the IQA is trying to expand. And we have something that we actually call Kidditch. So instead of just having like the Quidditch where it's the college players, more competitive, kind of rugby-ist tackling going on, we make it for the kids. So maybe the hoops are a little shorter or different balls. The brooms, a lot of the time, we'll use like foam noodles instead of like wooden ones so they're not running into each other. But it just sort of makes it so that the kids can play and get involved too versus, you know, the college kids where it's a little bit more competitive. They can have fun while, you know, we go and compete.
But the college students are really the ones that have spearheaded this
yes,
Quidditch craze.
Yes, they really are. My part this last year, because unfortunately I graduated back in 2012, I actually participated as part of the organizing team for the Quidditch World Cup. And this was Quidditch World Cup 6 this year. So, I mean, we've had one every year for the past 6 years, and it's just grown and grown.
Christina Packard, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having us.